Oak Session number 13206, Reel 1.
Mr. Revel, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
In Sobridgeworth, in Hertfordshire.
And that was in 1920?
1921.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, I suppose, generally speaking, he was either employed as a labourer, and he did, in fact, run a small boot repair business for a time.
Did you go to school in Sobridgeworth?
Yes.
And how old were you when you finished your schooling?
14.
So that would have been in 35?
That's right.
Did you get a job?
Yes. I became an office boy in the offices of a local company which produced malt extract.
And what were you doing when war was declared?
I was still working for the same company, by which time I'd progressed from an office boy to an invoice clerk to a sales ledger clerk.
And what was your reaction to the news that we were at war with Germany?
Well, I suppose really it was inevitable that it was going to happen, and furthermore I began to take an interest in the Royal Air Force as a result of visiting a couple of the local Royal Air Force stations with our village cricket team. This was Royal Air Force Debden, which of course was a fighter station, and Royal Air Force North Weald, which was also a fighter station. So when the war came, it looked to me as if I was going to be provided with an opportunity to go into the Royal Air Force, which I wished to do, but which family circumstances dictated I couldn't really. My father had died when I was 16, and I was feeling rather responsible for my mother. And when I talked to her about joining the Royal Air Force before the war, she took the line, well, if the Air Force can provide you with a better home than you've got here, you go and take it. So I elected not to. But of course, when the war came and I knew that I would obviously be conscripted, I knew then, of course, I would perhaps be able to achieve this interest in getting into the Royal Air Force.
When was it that you joined the RAF?
In 1941, I registered as part of the normal procedure, expressed a preference to go into the Royal Air Force, and I was in fact instructed to report to RAF Cardington for an interview in March of 1941.
Before then, had you been in any of the bombing?
Well, my home was 25 miles north of London and was obviously in the area which was in fact to some extent involved with Battle of Britain and certainly the Blitz on London.
Did any bombs fall in the Sobridgeworth area?
Oh yes, there were a number of sites which were in fact hit, either by, well, shall we say, random bombs or by what appear to be more deliberate attacks.
Can you remember any particular bombs or any particular buildings or roads that were hit?
Well, yes, certainly. There was two or three, I think, hit a row of council houses on the Cambridge Road, in which a friend of our family was killed, a Mrs. Falker. She had lived three doors away from us until about the time the war broke out and had been moved into a council house, and it was one of those that was hit at that particular time. And then of course the local joinery works, which had been put on to war work producing wooden aeroplanes like the Oxford and the Mosquito, owned by Sir Walter Lawrence, was hit on one occasion.
That was a stroke of good luck for the German Air Force that they happened to hit there.
Well, I suppose one must assume they might have known what was going on there.
What were the names of the streets where the joinery works and the council houses were situated?
Oh, the council houses were on Cambridge Road, and the factory site known as the joinery works was alongside the River Stort, off the shearing mill lane.
Any other particular bombs or buildings that were hit?
I can't recall anything in particular, but as I said, there was the odd sort of random, perhaps bombs that had been jettisoned or something of this sort, which fell in local fields and so on.
How did the local people take the bombing?
Well, I suppose in the same manner as most other places. It wasn't the sort of thing that you were very pleased to get involved in, but obviously it was a war.
But were people shaken, or was their morale good?
I can't say that morale ever seemed to suffer. There were occasions when we had sleepless nights and things of this sort, but I don't think that morale ever got to a point where one could say there was any sort of panic or anything of that sort.
Did you go into a public shelter during bombing?
No.
Where did you shelter?
My grandmother lived next door to my mother's home, and so we tended to spend time with her and just spent our nights in her kitchen, which was not protected in any way by way of providing shelter, really.
So you didn't shelter under stairs like some people did?
No.
Why not?
There wasn't room under the stairs.
So, coming back to you, you're joining the RAF. Can you take it a bit further, please?
Well, as I said, I went along for this interview in March, and they gave me a brief examination to determine whether I was going to be suitable for training as a flight mechanic. And evidently they decided I was suitable. I was attested and then sent home on deferred service. And was in fact called up for full-time service in May of 1941. Again, we had to report to Cardington, during which time we were provided with basic uniform and kit, and after about 3 days, by train down to Bournemouth, where I did my recruit training in the streets of Boscombe for about 5 weeks, at the end of which we were given a week's leave and told to report to Royal Air Force St Athan at number 4 School of Technical Training, I think it was its number, where I did a 17-week course as a flight mechanic airframes, had another week's leave and went straight back again to do a further 10 weeks training converting from a flight mechanic airframes to a fitter 2 airframes.
I'm familiar with the term fitter from pre-war people that I've interviewed, but what's the difference between a flight mechanic airframes and a fitter?
One could say that a flight mechanic was semi-skilled and a fitter was skilled.
So you changed from being semi-skilled to skilled?
Yes.
And then?
My first posting was to RAF Middle Wallop. This was in about February. I think it would be early part of February 1942. And I arrived there at the end of this leave with meeting another group of people who'd also passed out from St Athan at the same time as me, either in the airframe or the engines trade. And as I was saying, I was posted to RAF Middle Wallop in 1942 at the end of my technical training, together with a number of others who had all been trained at St Athan. Like most of the others, I started my service in the RAF the previous May. My short time at Middle Wallop was spent on the strength of 604 Squadron in their maintenance flight, which took care of night fighter bow fighters of Cat's Eyes Cunningham Squadron.
Was this a City of Something Squadron?
604 was the County of Middlesex Auxiliary Squadron.
Was Cat's Eye Cunningham with the squadron when you joined?
Yes, in fact, he was acting as a station commander at that time.
What kind of a chap was he?
Didn't have very much to do with him. I only spent about a fortnight there. He had obviously got a very good reputation.
Why were you moved so quickly from there?
By of explanation. After I'd been there for a week or two, I found myself as the rigger detail for duty crew with an engine fitter called Dolly Gray. He was an old sweat. And the day before our duty day, which involved handling any visiting aircraft, we were to relieve that day's duty crew at lunchtime so that they could get a meal, and so it meant to make a late meal for us with just about time to get a cup of tea in the naffy before it closed. While sitting in the canteen with Dolly Gray, Ginger Reynolds, another sprog fitter to A, came in to tell us that we were to report to station headquarters with him and several others. At station headquarters we were told that we were going to RAF Kirkham shortly to take a special aircraft course, have 28 days embarkation leave, and then go overseas to a squadron equipped with the type of aircraft on which we had completed this special course. We spent the next few days back in the hangars, during which time I did get involved a bit more than previously, and then were given a 48-hour pass before proceeding to Kirkham. I remember going home for that weekend and telling my mother that I was going on the course, but didn't say too much about the overseas part of the story. An uncle had died just before this, and the funeral took place whilst I was at home, so there was enough grief without adding to my mother's anxiety. The train journey from Andover to London and then on to Preston, etc., was the usual wartime excursion, with most of the passengers being in uniform. I remember on the London to Preston leg finding that a lot of the RAF bods on the train were all going to Kirkham, and that rations were provided from large cardboard boxes. Corned beef sandwiches and some fruit were shared, but nothing to drink. By the time we got to the railway station nearest to our RAF Kirkham, it was dark. We were duly fell in threes and marched up to the camp, humping our kit bags, etc., with the leading right-hand man carrying a white hurricane lamp and a red by the rear man. The hutted accommodation on a dispersed site was hardly completed, but we found beds and collected blankets. But before we went to bed, we started on the programme of vaccination, inoculation, etc., and the next day collected overseas kit. That day we were also allowed to post home any surplus personal stuff and were told that there was no course and no leave, but we would be moving off to a port of embarkation next day. In fact, within about 36 hours of arriving at Kirkham, we were loaded onto a merchant ship called the Cape Hawk in Liverpool, with all sorts of rumours concerning our destination. The last opportunity to ride home came that afternoon, and we set sail about dusk. I was volunteered by a warrant officer later found to be called Connors, and a splendid character too, with a couple of others to start on the spud bashing fatigue. This task was undertaken on deck, so we were able to watch Liverpool recede into the distance as the mountain of potatoes diminished on the 9th of February 1942. Accommodation on board was in the holds, with hammocks slung at night, providing a minimum amount of space to allow access, provided everyone took his turn preparing for bed. Most of the space was taken up by mess tables with fixed seating. We were about 120 strong, including a few senior NCOs and three or four sergeant pilots. Later on, we were to find that there were also some officers aboard, all pilots, except for Squadron Leader Shorty Hughes, who was an engineer officer and a wonderful leader, as we were to find out in the weeks to come. The senior officer was a Wing Commander McLean DFC, who I think was a New Zealander. And after a week or so at sea, he and Shorty got us all together on a hatch cover to tell us what we were setting out to achieve. In the holds below those we lived in were 16 Spitfires in crates and sufficient tools and equipment to assemble them and to take them by aircraft carrier to within flying range of Malta as the first batch of Spitfires to operate as fighters outside of the United Kingdom. Photographic reconnaissance Spits had operated abroad, but those were concerned sorry, those we were concerned with turned out to be Mark V's with a mixed armament of 20mm cannon and machine guns. If all went well, we would fly off the aircraft, return to Gibraltar, and await a convoy back to UK. Home in 6 weeks, they said. So the Special Operations Maintenance Party, or SOMP, was to be in existence for a short time only, it seemed. To enlarge on my other notes referring to the assembly of the Spitfires at Gibraltar and their subsequent dispatch from carriers to Malta, the following memories might be of interest. SS Cape Hawke moved alongside the Keen, which I believe was known as the Inner Harbour at Gib, on the 21st of February 1942. Also tied up alongside the Keen was the aircraft carrier HMS Eagle. The 16 crates were offloaded and lined up on the quayside. The need to exercise strict security was recognised. German spies were interested in all that could be seen from vantage points across the bay in Algeciras, etc. Spanish labour, which was always considered suspect, employed anywhere on the rock, had to leave their places of work and make their way to the frontier to be across into Spain before dusk, and were not allowed back onto the rock until after dawn next day. Incidentally, they were thought to be well off for food, etc., compared with the rest of the Spanish people, in that they had access to what was available in shops, etc., on the rock. Nevertheless, I did see them foraging among swill bins later on. We understood that they were allowed to take a limited amount of food back over the border each day, which included 2 loaves of white bread, one of which had to be sliced, presumably to ensure that it didn't stay fresh too long. Even stale bread was sought after, so fresh as was at a premium. A large proportion of the Gibraltarian population had been evacuated to England, especially those not in essential employment, and those remaining were thought to be loyal. As a result of this security situation, no work on the crates was to be undertaken in daylight. But as soon as darkness fell on February the 22nd, we were detailed off to start and prepare to open each crate in turn. The crates were of solid wooden construction with steel straps leading to slinging points at roof level. The ends of the crates were secured by a number of coach bolts accessible from wooden covers nailed to the crate. These covers were carefully removed and retained. The end of the crate was then removed to provide access to the dismantled aircraft, and then sufficient of the aircraft bits and pieces were removed to allow us to reach the bolts, securing the cradle on which the aircraft fuselage was mounted to the floor of the crate. At this point, a Coles crane was positioned to pick up slings attached to the lifting points of the crate at roof level and towards the open end of the crate. A controlled lift by the Coles crane driver, who was Royal Air Force, tilted the crate, pivoted about the end farthest away from the open end, so that a brave Irk could get underneath the crate to help slacken the cradle bolts, which were then removed from inside the crate. The Irk would then escape, and the crate lowered back onto its base. The Health and Safety at Work Act became law much later. Any equipment, etc., that had been removed was then restowed in the crate, the end closed up, and the access covers replaced. Any rubbish or other evidence of activity was tidied up, so that by next morning, when the local labour came in, the 16 crates were in precisely the same position and condition as seen at cease work the day before. By dusk on the 23rd, we were able to start work again on the quayside, commencing with the removal of the ends of the crates previously worked on. The Coles crane was used to help slide the fuselage out on its cradle, and the bolts securing the fuselage to the cradle were then removed. The crane then lifted the fuselage on a sling, pivoting on the tailwheel until a trestle could be positioned just after the engine bulkhead, and the fuselage was then lowered onto the trestle. The main planes with supporting wooden frames were manhandled from the crate and positioned adjacent to the fuselage, stripped of their supporting woodwork, and again manhandled into position to allow a minimum number of the root end bolts to be inserted to secure the main plane to the fuselage. With main planes secured, the undercarriage uplocks were open, the undercarriage lowered and locked down. No attempt was made at this stage to complete the assembly of systems, etc. The crane would now take the weight, the trestle taken away, so that the partly assembled aircraft would be moved to a point where the flight deck crane on HMS Eagle could hoist the Spitfire aboard onto the flight deck. Remember, this activity was taking place at night, but with a generous amount of lighting, as Gib wasn't blacked out until an alert was sounded. However, the lighting on the flight deck was kept to a minimum, particularly when the loads reached flight deck level. The bulk of the carrier shielded activity on the quayside, and when the Spitfire and or its subsequent load of bits and pieces needed to complete the assembly were lifted more into view, the fleet air arm boys arranged some activity on the flight deck, e.g. ground running Hurricanes, to camouflage the genuine bustle. As each aircraft reached the flight deck, it was then pushed onto the lift and taken below or struck down to the hangar deck. Its associated items followed, having been lifted from the quayside on a large pallet on wheels. These associated items included the propeller, tailplanes, rudder, elevators, armament, fairings, a 90-gallon drop tank, etc. As each aircraft crate was emptied, all evidence of disturbance was again erased and the site left as it ceased work. During that night of the 23rd, 24th of February, we had uncrated and moved 12 aircraft onto Eagle, having spent the day of the 23rd moving stores and ammunition. During the day of the 24th, we moved from Cape Hawke onto Eagle, and during the night of the 24th, 25th, got the remaining four aircraft uncrated and aboard Eagle by the early hours of the 25th. We then went to sleep on safari beds on the hangar deck under the aircraft. These beds were lightweight metal frames about 2 feet wide and 6 feet long when assembled, over which had been secured a canvas cover. The frame was mounted on four metal cross members, which provided about 3 inches clearance from the deck. The cross members were detachable, and when not in use, the whole lot rolled up into a cylindrical shape, 3 feet long, 9 inches in diameter, rather like a camp bed. We had a pair of blankets, each supplied by Royal Navy stores, as were the beds. During this period, we had been introduced to Royal Naval routine, shown to our mess decks, and served Royal Navy meals. All rather different to the Royal Air Force, and their experience on Cape Hawke served only as a very inadequate introduction, really. We started to pick up naval jargon from members of the crew and from the pipes broadcast over the ship's tannoy. Jolly Jack was usually a very helpful character, and the Royal Marines, whose bandsman provided the hangar guard come fire picket, soon became quite well known to us. Among our number was an ex-Marine, Harry Parry, who soon found how to scrounge a tot, although we were not issued with rum as were the majority of the ship's company. Cook of the mess was a daily duty, where each mess table provided one man to collect meals from the galley and supervise the sharing out of bulk quantities. He cleaned up after meals and carried the can if during rounds by the officer of the watch things were not in order. He also took orders for goods from the ship's canteen, as we were allowed to buy 20 cigarettes and a bar of nutty, that's chocolate, each day at a very low cost. When going ashore, we had to use the Liberty boat, even though we were tied up alongside the quay. This involved a close inspection by the officer of the watch to ensure a high standard of turnout. This was very difficult for us to achieve, as we had only one suit of blue, having exchanged the other for khaki drill at Kirkham, which had to be worn at that time of year. As we had no overalls, our blues were a bit scruffy after 10 days or more on the Cape Hawke, plus our more recent activities. Coming back on board after a run ashore included the mandatory requirement to salute as you came over the brow, and heaven help anyone caught failing to do so by the officer of the watch or his senior rate who were in attendance at the head of the gangplank. Having worked half the night of the 24th and 25th and settled into the safari beds in new surroundings, it seemed only an hour or so before a roar from the duty leading hand invited us in no uncertain terms to rise and shine. It was obviously his job to ensure that no one overslept, but as this was at some unearthly hour of 06:30, we thought that he must have made a mistake, thinking we were sailors. We retaliated by reminding him that we were Air Force, and so perhaps his early morning call didn't apply to us. He was in fact a telegraphist air gunner from the Swordfish Squadron, a couple of whose aircraft were retained on board together with a couple of Sea Hurricanes. As he towered above me on my safari bed, wearing his teddy bear flying jacket, etc., he seemed enormous and not the sort of chap to argue with, so we got up and started to prepare for the first day of the proper aircraft assembly programme. Our working day was from 8 o'clock in the morning to 23:59, midnight, with time out for meals, of course, and throughout all the foregoing activities. And from then on, Squadron Leader Shorty Hughes, who was our engineer officer, was always on the ball, encouraging, organising, and often had his jacket off to give a hand. We had been organised into gangs by trades. We riggers, that's the airframe trade name, were in eight gangs, each with a corporal in charge, with three of us under his control, and each gang had two Spitfires to build. Those of us with little experience started to learn quickly. Fitters, that's the engine trades, had their coolant systems, etc., to connect and fill, props to install and the like. Electricians, instruments and radio trades were obviously in the minority. Armourers were kept well occupied with installation of cannon and machine guns, building up ammunition, and subsequently the harmonisation of the armament and gun sights. A high proportion of the NCOs and IRCs I found were from maintenance units used to handling repairs and major components on Spitfires at fighter airfields. My gang was led by Ted Foster, who at the time was a senior leading aircraftsman, there not being enough corporals to go around in our trade. This resulted in Sergeant Richardson taking a close interest in our efforts, as all our work recorded in the Form 700 had to be oversigned by an NCO. I worked on the installation of tailplanes, elevators and rudders, together with the connection of associated flying control runs as an AC-1 with George Allwright, who had been with on repairs to Spitfires at various stations in South England. Ted Foster and Harry Parry worked on the completion of the attachment of main planes to fuselage and the connection of systems at the route end, i.e. aileron controls, undercarriage jacks and controls, pneumatics for operation of flaps, gun cocking, gun firing, wheel brakes and landing extension, and the mechanical operation of the radiator shuffle. Once all this had been done and tested as best we could in the hangar and the other trades were ready, the aircraft was taken onto the lift, brought up onto the flight deck for engine runs and fuel transfer checks from the 90-gallon jettisonable tank slung below the fuselage centre section. Eventually, the armourers would take over to do their harmonisation. As soon as essentials were finished on our first aircraft, we moved to the second, and of course there was a bit of competition between the gangs to see who made the best progress each day. Shorty Hughes, assisted by Warrant Officer Connors, Flight Sergeant Scadden and a handful of sergeants, kept everything on the move but took opportunity to assess how we youngsters were coping. Around midnight, Shorty would make his rounds and tell those of us who showed signs of fatigue that we had better get some sleep. Flight Sergeant Scadden seemed to inherit the job of getting the aircraft moved around the hangar, up on deck or on and off the lift, and was dubbed Tail Arm, as he always had a tail steering arm to hand. As before, flight deck work was carefully monitored and ground running, harmonisation etc. was undertaken under cover of darkness. Work continued through February the 25th and 26th, and at about 2 o'clock on February the 27th we put to sea to proceed towards Malta, but after about 20 hours the operation was cancelled and we turned back to Gib. Our escort included another carrier, HMS Argus, a battleship, HMS Malaya, a heavy cruiser and 10 destroyers. Depth charges were dropped, but there was no apparent enemy activity, although it was always expected. We were back in Gib by 2200 hours on the 28th of February, by which time most of the assembly work had been completed. One aircraft had been nominated as a Christmas tree from which spares could be borrowed when required, assuming they were not otherwise available. There had been considerable troubles during engine runs in getting reliable fuel transfer from the 90-gun and drop tanks. The tank was located below the centre section of the fuselage, roughly between the undercarriage legs, and was held to the aircraft by a spigot on the top of the tank, engaging a housing in the underside of the fuselage, which included a locking mechanism which could be released from the cockpit. Two hooks were fitted to the bottom of the fuselage, just about the rear edge of the tank. The tank was formed from light alloy as a flat, streamlined shape, and when jettisoned in the air was intended to fall away, the two hooks preventing it from sliding backwards with consequent risk of damage to the aircraft. A filler cap was provided at the upper part of the front of the tank, and fuel was transferred by suction through a spring-loaded connection standing part of the tank top, which lined up with a connection more or less flush with the underside of the fuselage. Suitable washers and liberal quantities of grease were used to make an airtight connection between the tank connection and the aircraft fuel system as the tank was locked up to the fuselage. There was also a vent pipe running along the top of the tank with the aft end open.